Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Project Zion podcast. This is your host, Robin Linkhart, and today we will be exploring ministry and mission with President of 70, Karen Peter. Now, I know that name may sound familiar to you here on Project Zion because Karen is our host for the Common Ground series, where she skillfully walks us through the Christian liturgical calendar, interviews fascinating guests, and fills in all the liturgical colors. Thanks for being with us here today, Karen.
Thanks for extending the, quote, invitation, unquote.
So how does it feel to be on the other side of the microphone, so to speak?
It is extremely uncomfortable to be on the other side of the microphone, and I am developing a strong case of empathy for the guests that I interview.
I can totally resonate with what you're saying. So, Karen, why don't you just catch us up on your current life? What's happening? Where are you? What are you doing?
So, I live in Olympia, Washington with my spouse, Ray. We have a blended family. We have 4 grown children and 12 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And it's busy. I work full-time for Community of Christ and serve in the North Central field. What else is exciting about life? We have a new puppy.
Uh-huh. And what is that puppy's name?
That puppy's name is Ella, and she is a yellow lab, and she is active.
So might that be kind of bubbling over into your life, too?
Just a bit.
So that's Ray's puppy, right?
It is Ray's puppy, although when you have a puppy, it's everybody's puppy. So we're getting used to that, having a pet in the house again.
Well, it does sound exciting. So we really want to get to know you just a little bit better today, Karen. So I'm going to ask you to kind of wind the clock back and let's start with talking about where did you grow up?
So I grew up in the South Puget Sound area in a town called Puyallup, Washington. And it was there that my parents participated in a Zionic gathering experiment in the late 50s and early 60s, just after they had joined what was then the RLDS Church, where church families bought some property adjacent to one another and shared in communal animal raising and gardening and all of the kinds of things that people do or did at that period of time in community.
Tell us about your faith journey.
So my faith journey, let's see. So I grew up attending church with my parents. That was an expectation. And I did that faithfully until I was a young adult. So let me tell you what happened. So I grew up in the church at a time where women were not anticipated to participate in the ministry of what we call in the priesthood. That was reserved only for men. And as a child, I searched for a loophole to that requirement and went in several different directions. At first, I thought maybe I would become Catholic because then I could be a nun. But when I looked it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, some of the photos and some of the information let me know that that was not going to be for me. So then I was reading the members manual and discovered we had military chaplains. So I thought if I grew up and joined the military, then I could be a chaplain and then the church would have to accept me as a minister. And it was explained to me that that's not quite how that worked either. So having that as part of my childhood kind of understanding of what it meant to be female in the church, by the time I was out of high school, I was a little bit frustrated at the expectation for the role of women in the church. And so my participation and attendance lessened to almost nothing at that time. And it wasn't until I was married with a young child and decided that perhaps he needed the experience of growing up in a church community that I really started to venture back in with my spouse in tow and having developed several habits and practices that were less than enthusiastically received by the church body. But nonetheless, I came back and began to experience again what it was like to be part of the community.
So how'd that go for you?
Well, it was a struggle for a long time. But once I made that commitment that I would be all in, that's where it went. It ended up, I think, with me being willing to really expend the energy and the focus that it took to really be a full-time disciple. It's like, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it all in. So by then, the church policy had changed and women were eligible to be ordained. And so even though I was all in, that was not something at that point that I thought I wanted to be a part of. So I made sure I kept hold of some of those practices and habits that would prohibit that from happening. And it took several years before I was willing to give those up. And after I did, I was ordained to the office of elder and then shortly thereafter to the office of 70. Because mission, invitation, is my area of interest in the life of the church.
So tell us a little bit about that calling process when you were first called to serve in the office of elder. As you know, we have a lot of seekers now, members in Community of Christ, whose previous faith tradition did not permit women to be called and ordained. And for them, this has been kind of a steep learning curve and maybe even unexpected times of questioning and uncertainty in that process. So tell us a little bit about yours, because you would have been among, not the absolute first, but in the first few waves of women in the Community of Christ who were called to serve in priesthood.
So it was 1992 when I was called to serve, and I was probably considered pretty young to be called to serve as an elder. I was 32, I think, or 33 at the time. So I think for me, I had the benefit of being in a pretty large, active congregation, and also had the benefit of traveling a lot in the what we would now call a mission center, but at that time it would have been the Seattle State, with my father when he shared in public ministry in a lot of different ways. So I had lots of good role models to draw on. But being a young female in that role was certainly a little bit different. I'm not really sure at that time if I recognized how different perhaps that was at the time. I do think, and did when I was called to serve as an elder, I did think that the reason I was not called to serve as an Aaronic priest was because I probably wasn't nice enough to be called to serve in ministries of family and relationships and reconciliation and those kinds of things. But I realize now that that was not the case, that really my underlying call has always been to the ministry of what we would call the ministry of the 70, which is ministry of invitation and hospitality and welcome and finding ways to connect people in Christian community and connect people with how they understand God and their journey with God. Those are all aspects of the ministry of the 70, but 70 come from the body of elders. And so I look back now and realize that's why that call was where I ended up.
So how many years have you served in the office of 70?
Well, I was ordained in 1995, and you can do the math. I would have to take off my shoes, and I'm not going to do that. So,
sounds good. Okay, listeners, we're counting on you to figure that out. So we know that now you serve as an employee of the church as a full-time minister. So tell us a little bit about what brought you to being employed as a full-time minister with Community of Christ. And then if you would go on to talk about the different roles, assignments, et cetera, that you have responded to and served in.
Well, I think I ended up serving the church by accident. I moved to an area where they didn't have a 70, and they asked me if I would be willing to be employed by that jurisdiction, and I agreed. And that led to participation in the church in a more, in a broader sense, and meeting more people and being involved in areas outside of that jurisdiction. And that that was really, I think, helpful as far as getting an understanding of what it meant to work for the church outside of a jurisdictional employment. And so when my husband and I moved to the Midwest, he was he's a retired now church appointee. And his assignment became one in the Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas area. And in that area, I went to work for that district as a youth minister, and then as a missionary coordinator. And then in 2004, I went under appointment, and we moved to Arkansas. And I was involved in mission as a missionary specialist in Arkansas. In 2007, the church began an experiment with a mission in assigning people in a role called a field missionary coordinator. And you should be intimately familiar with that, Robin, as you served in that role as well. And that's where a 70 was partnered with an apostle to serve in a field specifically to promote missionary concerns, evangelism, what we now talk about when we say invitational ministries or the broader context of mission. And so I served in the southern field and the south central field for several years, and now currently serve in the north central field with a wonderful field apostle, and am enjoying that.
And what year did you go into the Council of Presidents of 70? Because we know that's where you're serving now as your quorum.
That was in 2010. And the Council of Presidents of 70 was expanded at that time from 7 members to 10 members, with counsel given to the church that the number of members of that council would fluctuate according to the needs of the church as understood by the president prophet of the church.
And now you are the quorum of the quorum president of the 6th quorum of 70?
No, the 5th quorum of 70, which happens to be the quorum that I entered when I was first ordained, 70. And at that time, there were not very many women in the 5th quorum of 70. And so I'm happy to say that now in the 5th quorum, we have many, many women serving in the role of 70.
So one of the reasons it's hard to keep up with these numbers is the quorums of the 70 are assigned geographically, and those geography boundaries have changed multiple times since Karen and I were called to serve as field missionary coordinators alongside an apostle. And my last quorum that I served was 6, and Karen stepped in behind me and took it started out to be the same general area, and then very soon after that was shifted around. So
it's confusing.
It is confusing. So listeners, make sure you know Karen is the president of the 5th quorum of the 70. So let's get to the main topic of what we want to really explore today and hear about your life of ministry and experiences, and that is mission. What is mission to you?
So mission to me is how we understand our participation in God's purposes. So as I understand mission, it's to be engaged with God in God's purposes of salvation in the world. And when I say salvation, I'm not talking about doing good things to make sure you go to heaven or believing in Jesus so that you're saved. That's not what I mean. But it's to engage in the restorative activity of God in the world, where God is actively reconciling all of creation to God. And we participate with God in that and engage in that mission with God. And so it's the purposes of participating with the divine in that way. That's how I understand mission.
So we know the office of 70 is a missionary office in the life of the church, and you have been serving in that office for a number of years. But the world has changed a lot in the last 20 or 30 years. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how mission or missionary, however you want to talk about that, has been part of your ministry over the course of the time that you've served in the Office of 70?
So I'm not sure if everybody has this experience, but for me, I have always been a person who invites other people to participate in things with me. And if I was going to church, then I invited people to go with me. If my friends spent the night on a Saturday, it was expected they went to church on Sunday. But even as I got older in junior high and high school, I was always inviting people to camps and retreats and activities and even to church services, as boring as I found them when I was a teenager. And so that whole invitational nature, I think, is at the essence of what it means to be involved in Christ's mission, because it means that you're open to the other and that you're not focusing on your participation in church as something separate from the rest of your life, but that rather you're living in such a way that people are invited into what you're doing and into relationship with you. And it's a natural extension then to invite people to participate in the life of the faith community. So for me, that is what I engaged in before I was ordained. It's what I engaged in as an elder, and it's what led to, I think, me serving in the Office of 70. It's making sure that everyone has that invitation. So I was thinking about this earlier, and I realized that I used to always kind of blame my invitational nature on my dad because he's really gregarious and outgoing, and I realized that actually a great deal of it comes from my mom, who's kind of a behind-the-scenes minister and serves as an Aaronic teacher. But when we were growing up, she always made sure there was enough in case somebody unexpected showed up at the house. So it could have been young airmen and soldiers stationed at the local airbase or fort that might be church members and needed a place to go in the holidays, that kind of thing. It might be that she found someone at church that didn't have someone to be with at Christmas. And if that was the case, she invited them home. And there was always that extra Christmas stocking that was magically full of small gifts and candy for extra guests. I remember coming home one year for Easter and bringing two friends into the house with me Easter after church for lunch that my mom had not expected. And sure enough, two additional Easter baskets appeared with candy and that kind of thing. She was always prepared in that way. So we would call that now, I guess, an expression of our current hymnody, where we sing a place at the table for everyone. That's her practice. And I think I learned that from her. So I learned that early on, and as a full-time minister, it's how do I then take those principles that I've learned and apply them to working with individuals and congregations and people seeking a spiritual home in ways that allow us to kind of live into who we're called to be as a people. So we talk about Community of Christ being that table where all are welcome. And I tend to think of Community Christ, to paraphrase the Gospel of Matthew, to liberally paraphrase, that we are that small seed that grows into a plant so large that even the birds of the air find a place in the branches. That's mission to me.
So you mentioned, Karen, that you've discovered guiding principles of mission as you've lived out mission in your life. You put hands and feet to your sense of invitation. How does mission maybe look different in different contexts and cultures? You've served a lot of different places in the U.S. I know you've also traveled abroad. What can you tell us about that?
So mission does look different in different places. I think there are some universals about mission that I've come to understand more fully. The first one, the first kind of universal principle is that mission is not about me. It's not about us in the church. that mission really does not follow my agenda and God is not all that interested in my schedule, but rather mission is about being open to the unexpected. Because if we think we know where we are going, God has a habit of surprising us in some interesting ways. The other universal, I think, is that when we engage with God in God's restorative purposes, it's really about relationships. It's about being open to other people, where they are and how they are, without any hidden agenda or unspoken expectation of them that they're going to change and be like us or somehow respond to us in a way that we have anticipated. So it's about the other. It's not my agenda. And it's the willingness to be open and to practice hospitality. I think those are universal principles. But the way that that's expressed is so different. So in the southern USA, for example, church going is a big deal. I mean, everybody goes to church. And so for our members of Community of Christ to talk about mission and to talk about reaching people that don't have a faith community or church home, that has a different understanding there because most people do have that. And if they don't, then they're those kind of people. You know, maybe the kind of people you don't want to hang around, or they're the kind of people that have some of those bad practices and habits that I had before I came back to church. But maybe, you know, we don't want those kind of people into church. And so part of engaging folks in mission then is helping people to understand that, that's not how God sees people. It isn't a matter of whether a person is good enough to be invited, but that rather it's a practice of being open to whoever God calls us to be in relationship with. Whereas in the Pacific Northwest, where I live now, it has for a long time been described as the most unreligious or unchurched area of the United States. And to be honest, I think a lot of people are really kind of proud of that fact in the Pacific Northwest. And so engaging people in some kind of faith community experience isn't as easy as inviting people to church, because that's not an expectation of the culture. And it's not something that most people in the culture even resonate with. And so the church has to look at how do we engage in community and how are we relevant in community in ways where we can make a difference in people's lives without having the expectation that that's going to look like people coming to church. And so that's a completely different experience. And that's just in the United States, where the church-going experience is so commercialized in a way where churches compete with one another for members. And in the United States, we have this mindset that bigger, bigger, bigger is better, as opposed to the focus on really being an authentic relationship in some kind of gathered community.
So I know when I first met you, in the years that we have been partnered in ministry, which has been, wow, I think it's been almost 20 years since I first met you. I've heard a lot of wonderful stories from you, and through your eyes and what you've witnessed, I have seen how the church is authentically engaging in life-giving mission in ways that echo the Holy Spirit. It's a very familiar testimony of the Spirit working in people's lives. But also at the same time, although familiar, very different, because you have served in different contexts. And as you say, when you're open to the Spirit's work, you never really know how that's going to unfold. What can you tell us about some of the things you've witnessed, and specifically how the life of the church looks when we are authentically engaged in that life-giving mission that makes our hearts sing?
So when I think about what happens in a group of people really fully engaged in God's purposes in the world, engaged in mission, I think of my friend Becky. Becky went to the same congregation that I did in Puyallup when I was a young priesthood member. And I remember one time she said she just couldn't miss church. She couldn't, on a Sunday morning, not come to church because it was so exciting and she didn't want to miss anything. And I think about that level of enthusiasm and joy and energy in a congregation that's actively engaged in making a difference in their community and that really welcomes people as they are into their midst and allow the presence of new members to change them as opposed to expecting that nothing will change. And the kind of crackling of electrical current that's in the air and that kind of an experience. So that's was my first experience with a community that, that really transformed itself missionally. As I've traveled in the life of the church, I've seen congregations experience that. And I've been with people as they've related the experience, and you have that same sense of joy, that same, their faces light up, and they describe that crackling of the spirit, that presence of an energy that is both indescribable and yet tangible. Mm. So I can think of a congregation that we have in Panama City, Florida, that was fairly small. I think maybe 12 to 15 people. And they had tried so many different things to get more people to come, particularly their young adult children and their young adult children's friends and kind of some of the things that that were important to them. And they were really intentional about what they were doing. And nothing really seemed to take for them. And they began to kind of get discouraged. And there's a 70 down there by the name of Jack Sanders. And Jack has the most wonderful Florida panhandle accent. So wonderful and so profound that sometimes I have no idea what Jack is saying to me because he also speaks very rapidly. But the gist of it is this, is that they had tried all these things to get people like them to come to church. And they hadn't really looked at where they were in their community and who was around them and who were the people who walked by their church on a daily basis. And so Jack started going to church and taking his barbecue grill and sitting outside and setting up a picnic table and grilling hot dogs and hamburgers. And anybody that walked by, he would just invite them to come to the table and eat with him. No agenda, no string attached to try to make them to come to church, nothing like that. Well, Jack just did that, not willing to give up for months. And slowly, people started to come and to return and to bring other people with them. And it began to be not Jack's event on Saturday, but a community event where the people of the neighborhood, when Jack showed up, they would be there waiting to set up the grills and set up the tables and chairs and to cook the food and to invite other people to come. And what was so interesting about this is that the congregation at that time was white, but the neighborhood is African American. And so all of the people who would come were from the local community. And little by little, people from the Saturday outdoor meal began to show up for church on Sunday. And this profoundly changed the congregational experience. So I think it's been probably 5 or 6 years since Panama City has been doing this, and they continue that tradition. But when Jack talks about it, because the joy is so profound, the congregation is able to navigate the changes, which I think is a good learning experience for us. When change is forced upon us, we dig our heels in and we resent the change. But when the change comes with such a deep sense of joy and that Holy Spirit electricity, which is how I envision God's Spirit, is so prevalent, then we're able to make those changes and do so with great love. So that's just one story.
I really appreciate hearing that and that familiarity of the crackle of the Spirit that you talk about. I've seen that too in very different situations and cultures and contexts, but that is the familiar piece of mission when it's authentic and it becomes life-giving. I often call it the joy is bubbling over. And to hear people say, I get texts sometimes, I can't wait to go to church tomorrow.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that.
Or to just be in community doing something together. Mm-hmm. And there are times that I've been with maybe one or two other people and the discussion comes around to a sense, just this really profound sense that you're so connected to what's happening there. And the discussion that you're having or the conversation or the questions, and you can literally feel this crackling presence around you. It can be in a small group where two or three are gathered, or it can be in a big old building full of people.
I've heard Andrew Bolton call that the tingle factor.
It is a tingle factor, indeed. And it gets me all verklempt because deep inside I'm just a big softie. So
that's what happens. Yeah. Karen, as you experience this over the years and as you look into the future and to the challenges of our current day, what are some of the key questions that you think we need to be asking ourselves today in this context of not only the church context, but the world, where we find ourselves today in this world?
Well, I know I have way more questions than I have answers because they run through my head all of the time. So one I think that is really important for us to look at is what are the driving forces in our current cultural context where we live, wherever that may be, whatever region of the world in which you live, what are the cultural forces at work? And sometimes people have a hard time when we talk about culture and the church because they feel like the church is capitulating to modern culture. But in reality, the church has always responded to the culture in which it has found itself. And Apostle Paul wrote eloquently about living in the culture and the way in which we engage people in their context. So understanding what are the driving forces in our cultural context. And when I think about my current context in the United States, there are things like the very diverse family structures that we have at play now. I have a multi-level blended family. So we have all the prefixes you can assign of ex and almost and former and step and adopted and all of those kinds of things in our family structure. And how families look, it's so different now when we have same gender parents and we have transgender family members and we have a lot more single people or couples who do not have children. And so what a family looks like is changing in our cultural context. The other thing is that we have this 24/7 on button in our culture, and we seem to not have the ability to separate ourselves from the digital world and the electronic world, and that's becoming our new norm in our culture. But it also affects our relationships because so much of the time we're so busy that the time we do have for authentic relationship is spent on Facebook or texting another person rather than really having a deeper relationship with someone, an interaction with someone. And then we have the reality of we're in a family, the adults all have to work. And part of that is because consumerism drives our being at this point, our cultural being, where we think we have to accumulate more and more things or have more and more things. And that sense of consumerism has even found its way into the way we consume religion or consume spirituality. And so we search for something better, or we search for something more palatable, the way we would search maybe for a physician that we liked better. And so as we consume things, religion and spirituality, as a culture, that changes then how the church and individuals and families interact. And we just have to be aware of that. So that's a long answer to my long question. But that's the reality of which we live in. It's changing so fast. And it's sometimes so hard to keep up. But we have to be aware of that. And so the question that follows is then how do we live missionally in that reality? If we really look at what our culture is like and what's driving it, what does that mean for us? And I think about the reality of the news business. It used to be that you got your news at 5 o'clock for half an hour and you got a newspaper. And now news is, oh my gosh, it's an atrocity, but it's on all the time. And most people don't read newspapers anymore. And so in the church, it's almost like we're still publishing newspapers, expecting people to get their news that way when everybody's getting their news on their smartphone. And so we have to look at that and say, what is it about the church and how we do church that we need to really be honest with ourselves about if we want to be relevant in the world and if we want to be those people who are, if we want to be those people who are living community in such a way that it brings blessing in the world. So we have to be honest with ourselves. The other thing, and I think it goes to your bigger question, is what are the political and social and cultural trends that are contrary to God's purposes of reconciliation and restoration in the world? And again, when I say that, I'm talking about God's purposes of salvation, to restore and reconcile all of God's creation to God's being. And there are so many things that are in our cultures and our communities that are divisive and ugly, and even use Christian context and language of faith and banners of faith to alienate people, to marginalize people, that are hateful and discriminatory. And we have to be aware of that. And we have to be aware at how subtly you can be sucked into some of that if you're not aware and not cognizant of what's happening. So we need to look at those things and say, how then do we share a message of a loving, compassionate, reconciling God in the midst of what has become a really divisive public rhetoric? That would be a big question for me. And it's a question I ask myself as well as people that I serve.
In the spirit of the scripture, always be ready to give accounting of the hope that is in you. I want to ask you, what are your hopes for the church?
Yeah. Well, my biggest hope is that we will really live into our enduring principles. I think the enduring principles are a tremendous blessing to the church because they articulate what the call of God is to us, what it should look like. And so living into those is probably my most profound hope, that we will actively engage in what it means to be a people who promote peace, who work for justice, who proclaim God's love for everyone. What does that really look like as we do that? And it includes some really hard things to do that. So things like not putting yourself first, things like doing the really hard, humble work of reconciliation and healing. None of us like to be wrong and make mistakes, but when we do, we have to own up to that. So to practice that. And when we do that, I think we will become a people where that joy and that profound sense of awe crackles around us. And what comes out of that is this openness to other. And it's almost as if invitation is both the beginning of mission and it's also a byproduct of mission. Because when we are missionally engaged and when things are snapping and popping and cracking around us and we're really feeling like we're engaging with God and God's purposes, we can't help but invite other people into that experience with us. So it is both the beginning and the end, if you will, of mission.
I know you are a very well-read person and you are completely familiar with just about any resource we could name that Community of Christ puts out. So I want to ask you, what resources might you recommend to our listeners as we discover how God may be calling us to live missionally in the context of our lives.
Well, as far as church resources, we have wonderful writers and curriculum developers, but we have some fairly new resources in the life of the church that, gosh, people have been working on for some time and that we have talked about at length. And one of them is the three booklet LCM, kind of the best of LCM, which is Leading Congregations in Mission. And I know that Project Zion has interviewed people about leading congregations in mission before. But those resources and this really easy to use packet of three texts, I think, are a valuable resource to the church. If you're interested in really engaging in the practice of mission as a congregation or as a group of leaders together. The other is the small group resource that's just now coming out called Sacred Space, that's for that small group of people gathering together that want an alternative experience to the typical Sunday morning worship experience. And it's really easy to use and will be able to be downloaded for free from the church website and from the LatterdaySeekers.org website. Both of those are fairly recent and I think are user-friendly right out of the chute. There's an old resource that I really like that used to be given to all the 70 in what we call the Missionary Toolkit. And that's a resource that was written by Tammy Lindell, and it's called First Steps. And it actually has 10 lessons for intergenerational use with materials list and instructions. And it's just a wonderful resource for congregations that maybe don't have children's classes or have kids in their community, but want to be prepared in case they do. I would encourage people to take a look at that and get a large Rubbermaid container and put the ingredients for a few lessons in the container and label it so that when you do have children come to your congregation, you're prepared for that. Outside of print resources from Community of Christ, I would say our people resources are one of our best resources to share. And we have presidents of 70 around the globe, and those are always great people to call on for ideas that would be helpful for specific contexts and specific areas of the church. But we also have wonderful people serving in the Office of 70 all around the church. And they are wonderful resources for help, for support, for ideas, and that kind of thing. And I would want to hold them up as a terrific resource for the church. There are also good resources to be found that are produced outside of Community of Christ. And I'm also very cautious in saying that, because I don't want people to think that I'm advocating going to the local Bible bookstore and buying whatever happens to be on the shelf under evangelism, because I'm not advocating that. In fact, that usually is not helpful at all in the life of Community of Christ. But there are some resources that are out there, or some books that are out there, that help us reshape our understanding of what it means to be relevant in our current culture. And so books by authors such as Nadia Bolz-Weber, who is a Lutheran pastor. She wrote Pastrix, she wrote Accidental Saints, and she is a wonderful, very outspoken and colorful writer. And I would encourage you to look at some of her work. And then also, there's a book that we've shared in the life of the church for some time called The Tangible Kingdom, which is a good way to explore what it might look like for a congregation to reshape themselves, to engage in mission in their current context, and to look at it from a different perspective. So I would recommend those. And then I would also recommend my faves, just because I have some, two current faves that have to do with the United States context. And the first one is from Marcus Borg. And I think it was the first incarnation of a book that you read as a second incarnation, but the one I read was called Speaking Christian. And it described the different terms that are bandied about in Christian community and helps walk you through what they actually mean in Christian context, and then how they've kind of been co-opted in different ways and have come to mean something else. And the other one that is a favorite of mine is called, gosh, I want to say it's The Quest for the Historical Satan. And I know that sounds, it sounds horrible, but it helps us understand where we get this idea that there's like a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other, and that somehow we can be tempted into doing bad things, or that somehow there's some being out there that wants to trick us into doing bad things. And it helps us understand our current context where that kind of language is used in talking about people's faith communities. And so I think if we're going to be responsible disciples and ministers, we need to understand those conversations more deeply. So I can recommend all of those, and people can email me at my church address, and I'm happy to share other recommendations.
Is there anything else you want to share with us today? A question you wished I'd asked you that you want to comment on?
Good heavens, no. This is exhausting. So, no.
So, as I said at the beginning, you are the host for the Common Ground series, and that has been very well received. And just wonderful lineup of guests that you've interviewed. Tell us a little bit about what's coming up next on Common Ground.
Okay, so now that I said no, I didn't have anything else to say, I really do. So I want to go back to that. And I, sorry, and then I'll go to the commercial for what's next. So here's what I'd want to say is that I would hope that if you are listening, that somehow your journey, your experience, your interest would lead you to just really being open and responsive to how God is calling you, and to be aware that there is no right way to engage in mission. There's just your way to participate. It's kind of like wherever you're hanging out with God and you're having a good time, you just open that up so that somebody else can join with you. So I would hope people don't think that there's some magic system or complete list somewhere to walk you through it. It's just you and God and others. Those are the ingredients. So they're the only promise that I can make, and it's not even my promise, it's God's promise, is that is wherever you do that and however that goes, God's with you in the journey. So now for the commercial. What's coming up? Well, I'm so glad you asked. We are coming to the end of what we call the Christian calendar. And so as we conclude the cycle, we're going to have a podcast on the reign of Christ. And this really caught my attention because it was only included in the Christian calendar since 1928, which I was quite surprised. So when I began to research reign of Christ, or in some cases it's called Christ the King Sunday, I realized that if we were being putting it into restoration lingo, we might call it Coming of Zion Sunday. And so that will be at the very end of the calendar. It's the last Sunday of the Christian calendar. And then we're going to start the new cycle with Advent.
Exciting. That is really exciting.
Absolutely.
So we're still in ordinary time, is that right?
We are in ordinary time, and All Saints happens in ordinary time, as does Reign of Christ Sunday. So wear your green for ordinary time.
All right. I told you this liturgical calendar was colorful, folks. Well, Karen, I want to thank you for being with us today. And all the things that you have shared with us, you have put flesh and blood on mission, and I'm excited to go out there and hang out with God and others and open myself to what might come next. Who knows? This is Robin Linkhart, and you are listening to Project Zion Podcast. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.